The History of Literature podcast is a member of the Podglomerate Network and Lit Hub Radio. Hello, listeners. What has done it for you? Was it that moment when you returned to the beach? Maybe after not seeing it for a few years or even a decade or two, and you smelled the salt water and felt the breeze on your face and gazed out at the gorgeous waves churning under the sunrise or sunset, and you thought, why? Why did I wait so long? Or maybe that moment when you took a bite of a favorite dish, something you once loved but just kind of forgot about. Or maybe it's looking at your longtime love partner, the one you viewed as your fellow errand runner and task completer. But the light catches them in a certain way and you think, yes, this is more than just being roommates and co-workers and the projects of keeping a house clean and kids growing up. This is a partnership, a romantic partnership, a love that I give and receive, and I am lucky. I'm talking about moments of passion in everyday life, not basketball to a LeBron James or music to a Taylor Swift, but those things that make life worth living for the rest of us, those things that surge and sometimes fade. I've been thinking about this lately, probably because I'm at the age now when I can remember old passions that have ebbed and flowed. And sometimes they rise up again when I can find the time, or sometimes just the energy, and sometimes I need a spark to get me going. Having kids will do that to you. Oh, right, riding a bicycle. Forgot how pleasant this feels. Or, oh yeah, fishing. I used to do this a lot. I enjoy it. But I'm also thinking about this because of the conversation I had with today's guest, Bob Blaisdell. Bob, like many of the people I talk to for this program, is in the literature game or business. And for most people, I think that starts with a passion, but that doesn't mean the passion will continue. Bob's been here before to talk about Chekhov, which is another one of those passions of mine that will come and go. It's always somewhere in me at a low level, simmering away, and then it will surface to a roiling boil. For Bob, it was a Norwegian author who rekindled his spark, Karl Ove Knausgård, author of the My Struggle series. I'll let Bob tell you all about how Knausgård reanimated his love for literature, how he then got the chance to interview Knausgård twice, and the book he's now the editor of, Conversations with Karl Ove Knausgård, where one of the more innovative and obstinate authors treats his interviewers with attention, generosity, and unflinching honesty. A conversation with Bob Blaisdell about conversations with Karl Ove Knausgård today on the History of Literature. Okay, here we go. Welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, Jack Wilson. And speaking of passions rekindled, one of my old passions used to be books with title like, books. One of my old passions used to be speaking correctly. No. One of my old passions used to be books with titles like this one, Conversations with ... I must have read at least a dozen of these, maybe more, back in the day. I was glad to see that the series is still around. I love these books. Conversations with Saul Bellow, Conversations with John Updike, Conversations with Joyce Carol Oates, Bernard Malamud. If you were to Google your way into a bunch of interviews, you could probably find a few of these online, but you know what? It wouldn't be as good as getting a collection that's been edited, curated for you. You might read two or three interviews where the interviewers ask the same questions and get the same answers, or you'd read an interview that wasn't all that interesting, or there'd be the same interview hiding under links that look different. So you'd be clicking your way through, and then you'd realize you've just opened up eight different tabs with six of them having the same interview. It wouldn't be the same experience. It's much better to have someone doing the work of pulling the interviews, culling them, picking the best, editing them into readable format, and putting it all between two covers. It's like going to a restaurant and saying, I'd like shepherd's pie. And the waiter comes out with 10 potatoes and 5 carrots and some flour, sack of frozen peas and a pound of ground beef, slaps it all on the table, along with other ingredients you don't need and would just be in the way. You wouldn't starve, but your experience wouldn't be satisfying. Getting the book Conversations with ... has a chef who is working in the background, invisible, but making it so that all you have to do is eat. Knausgård is an especially interesting interview. I don't want to go into why, because that's what Bob will tell us about, and he's the expert. But let me give you a few facts about Knausgård's life in case you haven't encountered him before or you need a refresher. Karl Ove Knausgård was born in December of 1968 in Oslo, Norway. He studied arts and literature at the University of Bergen, then worked an assortment of jobs teaching high school, selling cassettes. That is a very particular time period. Working on an oil platform and so on before finally catching some success with his novels. He was writing all that time, but he finally caught some success when he was around 30. He published a couple of novels, which won awards, although people didn't know quite what to make of him. And then he found a huge success with his series of autobiographical novels, which he called Mind Kampf, or Mein Kampf, or My Struggle. Yes, he was using in Norwegian the same title that Hitler used. But in Knausgård's case, it was a deep dive into his own past and present. We've talked about the series before with Mike Palindrome, a Knausgård superfan. You can find that episode in our archives. The books were a runaway success. They sold 500,000 copies in Norway alone, and Norway has about 5 million people total. And it was a success in other languages too, a 21st century publishing phenomenon. Critic James Wood has the quote to end all quotes, or at least the Knausgård quote to end all Knausgård quotes. He said, quote, "There is something ceaselessly compelling about Knausgård's Mein Kampf books. Even when I was bored, I was interested." End quote. Knausgård has been compared with Proust and fellow Norwegian writer Ibsen, and he's since gone on to write several additional books, some of them autobiographical, and he's written essays, and he's one of those writers who digs so deep into his own life and the lives of his friends and relatives that fans find it hard to resist the question, who are these people really? Did this really happen? Do you still think this, Karl Ove? And can I ask you something personal? I feel like I know you. When you spend a few thousand pages with a confessor, you begin to feel like a priest. Let me ask you a few follow-ups, my son. And so interviewers wrestle with this too. You're fascinated by this guy and you want to know more, but at the same time, you think you already do know a lot about him, maybe more than you know about anyone other than yourself. But do you know him really? And will it be strange if he suggests that even though you've read all of this, you haven't really understood him at all? Enter the intrepid interviewers who have entered the fray, and the one who has gone through the results, Bob Blaisdell, who will tell us all about his own reading of Knausgård and what he learned from interviewing Knausgård himself, and what it was like to read and edit Conversations with Karl Ove Knausgård. Bob Blaisdell, and then a My Last Book with Nicholas Dames, our expert on chapters, coming up after this. Hello, everyone. This is Jack here to tell you about a way to eat better and easier. That's right, Factor. And they're delicious, ready-to-eat meals. These things are amazing. Chef-crafted, always fresh, never frozen. All you do is heat them up and you're ready to go. No prepping, cooking, or cleanup. And you get something healthy, nutritious, and tasty. I love Factor meals, especially on those days when I'm in the office. They're better for me than snacks or junk food. and much cheaper and faster than buying my lunch at a restaurant. You can choose options like Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, Keto, and you can change your schedule to get as much or as little as you need every week, whatever suits you and your family best. Head to factormeals.com/literature50 and use code literature50 to get 50% off. That's code literature50 at factormeals.com/literature50 to get 50% off. Hey, grown-ups, the Cat in the Hat cast is a new podcast from Wondery, perfect for the whole family. Join the Cat in the Hat and your favorite Dr. Seuss characters as they get whisked away on a new adventure every week. Fish dreams of creating his very own polite and quiet podcast. That is, until he gets a surprise visit to his Fishbowl podcast studio from the Cat in the Hat himself, and it becomes very clear that the cat has other plans for the podcast, and those plans are the opposite of quiet. The cat may be disruptive, but it turns out he's also a great help to get Fish out of all kinds of predicaments. Bursting with music, silliness, and rhymes, the Cat in the Hat cast encourages us all to find fun that is funny in every episode. Sing along to new favorite songs, try your luck at Titanic tongue twisters, have some fun with wondrous wordplay, and most importantly, bring your family along for all of the adventures in the Cat in the Hat cast. Follow the Cat in the Hat cast on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to the Cat in the Hat cast ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Wondery Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts. Okay, joining us once again is Bob Blaisdell, who is a professor of English at City University of New York's Kingsborough Community College, who has written several books and edited more than 36 literary anthologies. He was here last time to discuss his book, Chekhov Becomes Chekhov, about a miraculous 2-year period in the life of the famous Russian author and playwright. Bob returns today to discuss a new collection of conversations with Karl Ove Knausgård, which Bob edited. Bob Blaisdell, welcome back to the History of Literature.
Oh, thank you very much. Good to be here.
So when did you start reading Knausgård?
I didn't read him when he was at his height of excitement and fame in 2012 in America. I was bothered by seeing his image on the books, and I wondered about him. And then one day in 2017, I read a 2-page essay by him in the New York Times magazine.
Yes, I remember that.
About gum.
And, right.
One of my children had already read My Struggle One.
Uh-huh.
And it told me it was good. But when I read the essay, I thought, all right, this is somebody. And I went crazy. I read his book of essays called Autumn. And I was hooked.
Yeah.
That was 2017. And then I reviewed his next 3 seasons books. And by then I'd read My Struggle. I've now read My Struggle, all 3,600 pages, twice.
Wow. And what was your reading experience of My Struggle like? What did you make of it at first, and how did it develop over time?
It was... maybe I can only compare it to like a religious experience. I'm not religious, but I'm in regard to literature, I am. That's my religion. It gave me 21st century literature back. And most of what I read is 19th century.
Uh-huh.
And suddenly now the 21st century came to me, and the possibilities of fiction and writing came back to me.
Wow.
So it was thrilling. I didn't want to be like the other enthusiasts, but I was just another of the enthusiasts.
And yet, if you were to describe My Struggle to someone in a sentence, I'm not sure they'd run out and buy it. It would sound maybe like a long blog post or something. But what gives it that literary feel, and what has made it such a success story, do you think?
That's last weekend I tried to explain to my brother-in-law, why, what's this big deal about the book? And he gave me free space to explain why it was so great, and I could not get over to him. But rereading the conversations, it did come back to me in preparation to talk to you. It came back. It stripped away all the artifice of literature for me. And I think for many of the people who went crazy for it, suddenly the literature was alive again. It was life. It was life coming back the other way. Literature had so covered life, and this somehow, it through his literary experiments, as he called it, as he believed it to be, as he thought it would not be a, he still cannot understand why it's so popular, but it went the other way. It made life look like you could write about everything again, which was something of my feeling when I first read Tolstoy and Anna Karenina, was everything is possible to write about.
Mm.
And life is literature. I don't know. It was, I'm a little embarrassed because it was so exciting and so revelatory to me.
Do you think other 21st century authors, fiction writers, what do you think has gone? How has the energy been lost? Do you think it's because fiction has, there's been so much of it around, and technique is so common for everyone now, and everyone kind of knows how to write fiction, and it's drained some of the life of it, and he's kind of broken through that? Or what do you think is different?
That's good. That's what you just said. But there's the covering. So it was in a form, and you knew what was going to come, and you knew how it was going to proceed.
Right.
And there's comfort in it, and there's new things, but he broke through it.
Yeah, right.
And I mean, there are other 21st century authors which that helped me appreciate too, that do extraordinary things, and it brought 21st century literature back to me. I was more willing to find and seek other possibilities because I had closed the door. So he opened the door, and there's others. But for me, he's the number one.
He's the one. Yeah. Okay. So your introduction starts out with an exchange that I found arresting. So I thought I'd repeat that for our listeners. And the interviewer says, this is the interviewer of Knausgård. He says, but when you sit and talk about Karl Ove Knausgård in these interviews everywhere, is it like talking about a character almost? And Knausgård responds, no, it's like being a character. It's like going into a character. What do you think he means by that?
I did two interviews in the book, and the first one led to the book, and the second one, I wanted to ask him about the interviews. And so I asked him again about just about that, what you brought up.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you don't mind, I'll quote him.
Okay.
And how he responded to that in another place last year. I tell him, you told someone in an interview that you have a public you, that you have two lives. Quote, one is who I am there, and then I have this public one, and it's me, but it's still detached from me somehow. It's much more like a performance. I quoted that at him, and he said, And then I persisted, and you say it's like being a character to be Karl Ove. He says, yeah, well, that's still the case, because I'm quite reserved and shy. So when I have dinner parties or I meet someone who I'm not very, I haven't met much, my reaction is not to talk. I can be silent for about 2-3 hours in company with others, and I don't think anything I have to say is worth anything. And also, I can't understand how the others know what to say. It's like when people are talking about politics or art or whatever, it just comes out, you know, and I have no way of connecting to that, not at all. And then I can do that when I'm on a stage somewhere and talk about my books or whatever. And it's actually easy. It's not like I'm shy or anything. It could be hundreds of people sitting there and it's like it doesn't matter. It's very weird, but it's like the situation is almost liberating somehow. But it could be more personal and more close to myself there than I can be in other social situations. So that's why it's more like a performance, more like an actor's method, acting almost, doing yourself. But yeah, it's strange. And that's also why I see a connection to writing, because writing is the same. I've not a problem with expressing myself in writing, but I do have in almost any other social context. Mm. Does that get close to it?
Yeah, but let's unpack it because it's complicated.
Okay.
Yes. So here's a guy who, I mean, I would say he's become maybe second to Proust in being a guy who has written a long narrative that is basically based on his life and kind of the pieces of his life that he's putting together, and it's first person and is Carl and so on, right?
Mm-hmm.
And yet he doesn't necessarily say, well, this is autobiography. It's fiction. So he's got this sort of already, he's got this dichotomy of an author and a protagonist who are very close to one another in a lot of ways, but they're different. And then he's putting for us kind of his real self, which he says is shy and doesn't always know what to say and all of that. So that's almost like a third Carl. And then he's got this fourth one, which is the one where he's being interviewed when he's on a stage or something like that. And he's kind of saying, the one on the stage is kind of like the one who is sitting down to write. Neither of them is the true Carl, but in some ways it is kind of close to who he is. He's able to do things that the social Carl is not able to do, but none of those people are also the Carl who we see in the book, who is yet another entity, I guess. Which is the one that the Carl who sits down to write or the Carl who is on the stage has kind of created or can talk about. So I guess, I don't know if I've straightened anything out or if I've just confused things further.
So, well, let me try from another way. I was very proud of getting him to say that.
Yeah,
because
right.
For me, in the conversation, he does get back to the Carl Ove that he is, that is recognizable and alive, and you don't know what he's going to say, but it's alive and it's coming out right then. He doesn't know what he's going to think or say until he says it. He often says, and this is something I think is true for many of us who try to write, is the writing brings out the thoughts.
Mm.
It's not the thoughts that bring up the writing. What he tries to do in the conversation is, and what he does very well, and people, one reason why people did go to see him in the hundreds, however much an auditorium could hold or a bookstore could hold, they were packed because it was live. It was, he doesn't prepare for interviews. He just waits. And then he thinks out loud. He gets in that writing mode where he doesn't know what's going to happen. He doesn't know what he's going to say. And so he's not, you don't lead him in interviews. You kind of prompt him and he gets prompt himself and it just goes.
Yeah.
And that's different from my experience of interviewing other writers where there is a distinction. I'm like, this writer is one person. And then when he talks about his writing, he shows you he's a different person. But the Carl Ove on stage and interviews is very much like the one that goes deep and sometimes dark, but sometimes funny in the writing.
I was going to ask you what kind of interviewee he is, if he comes across as reluctant or generous, or does he get irritated in these different conversations, or does he just seem like he's always digging deep and delivering answers that are beyond the expectations of what even an interviewer might expect?
From that same interview that you quoted, that I use as an epigraph to the book, and it's by a Norwegian journalist, and it is interesting to hear him speak in Norwegian. It's like hearing one of your friends suddenly go into their native language, and you don't know that native language, and you see this kind of speed and comfort.
Yeah, right.
But what I found in reading dozens and dozens of interviews and listening and watching dozens of interviews and seeing him in person, I didn't interview him in person. I interviewed him on Zoom both times because of COVID and because of his living in London. He's remarkably consistent. And that part two, so I'm going to just quote a short paragraph this time from that Norwegian journalist Alf Marius Opsahl, who's interviewing him just outside of Karl Ove's apartment building in Sweden. That's where Karl Ove lived for about 15 years after leaving Norway. Friendly, but also uncomfortable. From time to time, he spoke in long tirades as if his thoughts were flying in all directions. But he then would also suddenly become introverted and silent, as if what he wanted most of all was just to disappear back to where he'd come from, the balcony, chain smoking, and solitude.
And that's something you saw throughout other interviews as well?
I saw and felt in our interview the politeness. The politeness is very impressive, and follow-up emails to the first interview, very, always polite. When he missed our second interview and his agent was explaining to me that, he's very busy, and he apologizes. And the first thing he said when we got together for the rescheduled interview was, "I'm sorry, I just completely forgot." And that disarmed me completely. No excuses, to just, "I forgot."
Right.
And so he's disarming in that way. And he won't agree. I'm used to, in conversation, we agree with one another because we want to agree. And he doesn't do that. So some questions just go flat. So we go to the next question.
Yeah.
And it's a different mode because he is back there. He is waiting kind of to be activated by his own thoughts. It's exciting. It never seemed canned. I was anxious, but also excited while interviewing him.
I was going to ask if the Knausgård that we see in interviews is what readers of My Struggle would expect. And it sounds like it kind of is, in the sense that readers of My Struggle would expect the unexpected, and he has the ability to deliver that.
Yes. And also one reason why I persisted in trying to interview him was, in My Struggle, which is also about my struggle, I mean, he was writing it at an incredible speed. He wrote the first 5 volumes in 2 years. And then, as he said, he screwed up the 6th volume and had to rewrite it, and that cost a year. But it was 3,600 pages in the very short time. And one of the things I kept reading and rereading, I was like, hey, he did 7 interviews one day, which he writes about in My Struggle, where he was being interviewed about my struggle. So there is the continuity. It just seems like we were in the pages of My Struggle.
Right.
And I was felt inside and outside at the same time. We were in a book and outside a book. And there was only one moment where You're a great interviewer, but I don't know if you've ever like stepped just too far. And I brought up his children, which he writes about his children all the time in terrific detail, intimacy. But I asked about his children as if they were, I don't know, as if at some, in some way, as if we were friends and I already knew about them.
Right.
And, but he pulled back a little bit and I pulled back a lot. I was like, no, I've crossed the line.
Yeah. Right.
His children are his children. And then there's the children that are in the book who are his children, but they're not.
Mm-hmm. And even though some people might say, well, he's put that on the table by making them part of the, by making them part of his work, you drew the line because you know he's calling it fiction, and it's not fair to kind of act like, well, he's put this out there so that we all know who his children are and we all have this kind of familiarity that we can assume with them.
Yeah, it helps me figure out, like, it is after all, it is a novel. And he's also himself very much like his own character. In some way, he doesn't care what my struggle was called, whether it's autofiction, whether it's one thing I think he would push back on is the word memoir.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause he's interested in all the things that fiction can do. When you go, I don't know what they said. I don't know what my mother said to me 40 years ago. These are obviously recreations, but he gets into a place where, as he says, he didn't notice anything at the time, but when he writes, as his ex-wife told him, you don't see or understand anything until you write it. And he brings that up repeatedly, that he doesn't understand his own experience until he's writing about it.
Okay, let's take a quick break and come back with more from Bob Blaisdell. Okay, Bob, let's talk more about the book. So what kinds of conversations do we have? Who are the interviewers and what are the circumstances? And I'll tee one of them up, which is you draw the distinction between him when he's talking in his native language and when he's talking in English and so on. You see some differences there. But are these generally, things we'd expect, interviews on television, radio, that kind of thing? What can you tell us about the collection as a whole?
The advantage was that there's so many interviews.
Mm-hmm.
And I did not, there's only a few, maybe two or three that he did in Norwegian that are in the book. Partly they just weren't translated. I don't know any Norwegian. So I think 20 of the 22 interviews are in English. And he was interviewed in English all over Europe by journalists and writers whose first language is not English.
Mm-hmm.
And so for instance, he would speak at writers' festivals in promotion of the various volumes of My Struggle coming out, and then as the Seasons books were coming out. But then I wanted... He did so many interviews about My Struggle, and about maybe half of the interviews, or a little less than half of the interviews, are about My Struggle. And then there are about the Seasons books, but also two books about Edvard Munch and a collection of essays. He goes to Lincoln Center in New York to talk about a Lars von Trier movie called The Idiots, where he's the guest. And he picked the movie for the audience to watch, and then he sat for an hour with a interviewer, the head of the documentary series there, talking about the movie. And that's one situation. He talks to somebody who helped set up his writing of a novella for a musical operatic performance of Peer Gynt. Where are some others? So he's very interested in art and movies, and I included those as a way to show him in those circumstances.
Yeah.
But there were so many to choose from, and the contributors were, this I also like. He told me that the interview depends so much on who he's talking with. I didn't argue with him about it, but I by that time I had read and seen dozens and dozens of interviews. I'm like, it doesn't really matter who you're talking to when you get into that mode.
Right.
There was only one person who had a big enough ego to kind of interrupt that ease.
Yeah.
I include that one, partly to show Carl Ove not at his ease. He couldn't get into the mode of just talking freely.
That's interesting. I'm guessing that the interviewers, I mean, as you mentioned, he's aroused so much passion and fandom. And I'm guessing that interviewers tend to have two real sets of questions that they want to ask him about. And one is the project. You know, what gave you the inspiration for this? What has it been like to write such a long piece? How did you write so quickly? You know, what do you view this as pioneering in some sense? Who are your influences? And all of that, just because this work is so almost unique. And the other, I would guess, is because it's so personal and it exposes so much, that they would bring to it a kind of, I want to ask you about your father, or I want to ask you about things that happen in the book, and kind of in a way that might not be the case if they were interviewing a different type of author. So do you see that in the interviews, that interviewers tend to approach Knausgård in a way that they might not ask questions of other novelists?
That's very interesting. So I would say the approach, everybody seems very prepared. Mm-hmm. Everybody, which is also interesting. Everybody's very knowledgeable about
what they're
talking about. Except the very first interview in the book, he had the only book show in New York, and he went to the Brooklyn Book Festival. This was before Carl Ove was known, and his first book was just coming out. And he had no idea who this guy was. The publisher said, you want to talk to this guy? All right. And so just trying to get Carl Ove to describe his book was difficult.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very exciting, because who is this guy? And the interviewer was very professional and knew what he was doing, but he was having to drag information from this taciturn guy sitting patiently at the Brooklyn Book Festival, just out of place, out of time, and get him talking. But after that, everybody was very knowledgeable. And besides, one of the interviewers are professionals and sometimes just young rookies, but they've read him.
Mm-hmm.
And this young guy from New Zealand asked him, what about the mechanical aspects of writing My Struggle? Would you mind if I read just an answer from Knausgård about that?
Sure.
Knausgård said, the speed is the most important thing. Both challenge the concept of form, but the speed has a practical element as well for me, because I'm a perfectionist in my writing, in my way of thinking. And I want to be clever, and I want to make it into real art, real literature. But I had to fight against that thing in me, because I became so critical of my own writing, and I needed to get over that. And the only way I could do it was by speeding up, because then you don't have time to be critical at all. It also allowed me to escape the notion of knowing what to write. If you know what you're going to write, then that's death for me. Then nothing is happening. If I plan something, it's just dead. And almost everything I write is dead in that sense, really. But if I speed up, then something all of a sudden is happening because I can no longer control it.
Yeah, that does seem like the key. Do you think he enjoys being interviewed? And I'll put this in a very particular way of, you know, you describe him going into this state when he's being interviewed and he's giving these answers, and the way it's a creative process, almost like when he's writing. And I'm wondering if he enjoys that and thinks, well, this is fun. This reminds me of writing, but maybe it's a little, a different change of pace, and it allows me to be a little social and kind of do the same kinds of creative thinking that I enjoy doing. Or do you think he's resentful in the sense of, well, I'm using myself up. I can only go back into dip into this well so many times. And every interview I give is, it's important for my career and the publisher wants me to do it and so on. But I do feel like it's taking its toll, and maybe maybe the well is going to go dry.
The answer is in between those mm-hmm. two propositions. I asked him directly, what do interviews give you? And he said, they give me nothing. Mm. I got him to equate it with the writing, but he said with writing, he's got something there. He said after the interviews, the best thing he could say about an interview was that he's forgotten it as soon as it's over.
Yeah, right. Right. Interesting.
When it goes poorly, then he remembers it and he's unhappy. And he says when he was young and first getting publicity, of course, he was excited and very pleased to talk about his book. And then after that, he insisted, no, he gets nothing out of it. He knows it's helpful for his publisher. And so he does it. He has his own publishing company in Norway. And so he sometimes has to interview writers, which he said he's not very good at. It takes a lot of work, as you know. And he's holding on to his questions, what to ask. But it's just a necessary thing that he does. It's not something he wants to do, but he does it as part of his duty. He is a man of duty. A person of duty, yes.
Right. You had a lot of experience reading Knausgård, and you had looked at a lot of interviews and so on, but did putting together this book and the process of that change your conception of him?
It didn't. It just gave me more,
yeah.
Which is what we always want with authors we love.
Yeah.
There's more. I have dreams where, oh my gosh, there's more Trollope novels. I mean, I've read all 47, but in dreams, there's even more there.
Right. So with that in mind, if you were to interview him now, and it would be, I guess, your third chance to interview him, are there questions that you would ask that you think interviewers haven't yet gotten to the bottom of?
One thing that I asked him in both, and I would just ask him again the way I would with any writer, like, what are you working on? And a nice thing with Carl Ove, sometimes it embarrasses friends who are writers but aren't working on anything, so it's an awkward question. With Carl Ove, he already worked this morning, okay? He already did his 2 or 3 hours of writing. And so that's something he can talk about. You know you'll hit with that one. If you ask Carl Ove, what did you work on today? He will have something to say. And he'll talk interestingly about it, about how, I mean, it took him 2 hours to, in the fiction, to mail a letter.
Right. And as you mentioned in the piece that he wrote, where it was 2 pages about gum, you would think it would be tedious or boring. And instead, he manages to make it almost electric, the way he describes it.
Yes. We talked about this in one of the interviews, about the scaffolding. It's not that scaffolding disappeared. The scaffolding is there, and the structure behind the scaffolding is also there. There's somehow this immediacy that his presence, you get right to it. And it's, you're having this literary experience, but you're having the immediacy that you only have with like certain people when you're lucky, you know, out in the world, where you're right there next to him. And that's one of the things that attracted me to Tolstoy, and it attracted me to Knausgård. It feels like there's almost no distance between you and the writer and the experience they're writing about. I don't know how they do it.
Yeah. Now, did you tell him either before the interview began or during the interview how important he had been to you and how he had reawakened your interest in 21st century fiction? Or is that something you kept to yourself?
My heart's on my sleeve. And I put it out there.
Yeah.
And he was polite.
Yeah.
So it wasn't too embarrassing. That could have been very embarrassing, but he was just polite, and then we moved on.
Yeah. And I mean, how does he feel about celebrity or about fandom? Does he seem like he's accepting of it, good-natured about it, or does it seem like it embarrasses him?
It seems like it embarrasses him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He's a very literary guy, of course, and so he doesn't see himself on top. He doesn't recognize that he is on top, or he is humble in his place, somewhat like the way Chekhov was. Mm. Like, yes, I'm out in the world and people know about me, but they're going to get over it. Which that was Chekhov's view. Tolstoy, on the other hand, knew he was on top of the mountain.
Yeah.
Knausgård does not see himself that way.
Right.
So it is embarrassing. Interesting.
Yeah. Well, I've also heard with someone like Paul McCartney, who obviously can't deny his own position, but he's so used to people who meet him for the first time and their mouth drops open and they can't believe they're seeing him. And he has a way of disarming them and making them feel comfortable, but kind of acknowledging, yes, it's me, but immediately putting them at ease. And I think it's because he can't live his life like that, that you'd feel like you're almost like a wax figure in a museum or something. If all your encounters are like that, it would feel like you're almost like an object rather than a person. And I wonder if part of Karl Ove has gotten to that point where he feels like he wants, if he's going to do these interviews, he wants to have conversations and talk about things other than himself and kind of the sort of regard and the attitude toward him that might impair him in some way, almost to feel like he's got to write up to a certain standard or that he's got to think of where he fits in the canon and so on.
He doesn't expect that anybody there in the audience, anybody, this journalist who wants to talk to him, this admirer, myself, that we've actually read him.
Hmm.
He doesn't take that for granted.
Right.
He's not professorial. He doesn't have his work over here. And of course, you know, he talks about it as if we don't already know those things. Also, he does say he tries not to think about it, that people know all amazing things about him that he never would have told anybody, as he says, he's too shy to tell people, but that he got to in the writing. It opens him up. I asked him about teaching because he's done a little teaching. And for me, teaching is a place where I can't believe I just said that to a group of 20-year-olds because I've never said it out loud to anybody else. And it opens up.
Yeah.
It's a place for where I opened up to my own surprise. And I think it's a good thing. And it's a place for him to open up in the writing and in the public conversation. He tells a very experienced Belgian journalist that as soon as they go backstage, he will not tell her anything. But he says somehow up on stage in front of 200 people, he can he can speak freely.
Right. And now we have the benefit of that all between a single pair of covers. The book is called Conversations with Karl Ove Knausgård. Bob Blaisdell, thank you so much for joining me on the History of Literature.
Thank you, Jack.
And finally today, a return appearance from Columbia University professor and author Nicholas Dames, who joined us earlier. After he and I discussed the history of chapters, yes, his project was that daunting. How do you write a book about chapters? How do you even start the research? You can check out that episode in our archives. But anyway, after Nicholas explained all of that, I asked him this special question. Okay, we're talking to Nicholas Dames, an expert in books and the author of The Chapter, A Segmented History from Antiquity to the 21st Century. Nicholas, this question comes from a listener who asks, what do you want your last book to be? This will be the last book you will ever read. You can either choose one that exists or describe one that has not yet been written.
So in thinking about this, I have to answer for two reasons. Marcel Proust's In Search of Lost Time, all seven volumes of it. And I suppose my first answer why would be because reading it is going to take a long time. And it'll maybe hold off death for a little bit, right? I can tell the Grim Reaper to have a seat. This is going to be a while.
And take your time. Read some of those sentences more than once, you know?
That's right.
Give yourself, indulge yourself a little bit, yeah.
I'll gain a few weeks on that one. But more seriously, because Proust's novel is about what lasts after us, it really is full of explorations of how we continue to exist in the lives of those who survive us. And also, you know, I think this deep idea in the novel that it really wants to hold on to, that no moment ever really disappears. So that, I think, might be very reassuring at that moment to consider. It's also a book about how to say goodbye to life. I mean, it was written largely in bed from the perspective of somebody in Proust's case who almost as if he understood himself as having died to the outside world in order to write it. And in fact, the book is about a writer who detaches himself, learns to say goodbye to the life he had known in order to write the book he has to write about that life.
Mm-hmm.
So all these farewells in it seem to me like a way to teach oneself at that moment how to say farewell.
But the hard part about it is that it is such a celebration of the memory and the mind and the feeling that that only Marcel was going to have that collection of memories in his mind. And even though you're right that it's nothing is ever lost because it makes this impression on the world and on people, I almost hate to admit this, but it does feel to me like one of the things I'm most concerned about in dying is thinking, well, my mind, which has been such a good friend to me, and I feel like has been, you know, full of so many interesting things and all these memories, that's going to be gone and the world is no longer going to have that.
No, I know that feeling. There's something, though, to Proust about this sense that you can almost have it all back one last time. And that's what I mean, I think, when I say it's about learning how to say goodbye. It's the way in which all the things that make up your mind and that, won't survive, you can have some way of grasping them all, not necessarily in thinking of them from beginning to end as a sort of, you know, chain of things that happened, but as all related to each other in the way almost like individual notes are related in a chord. So that you can have it all at once. One more time, you can have it bound up together and have not forgotten anything at the end somehow. Almost like the one final review through it all. You know, I hope we get that opportunity somehow to have one last feeling of life as existing in simultaneity, almost like a chord. And I think Proust does that. Expresses that idea better than anyone I know in the form of at least novels.
Yeah. And I mean, there is that common conception of your life passing before your eyes. And I think people, or maybe I'm just talking about myself, but when you think about that, you think of you know, as if you're watching a film in high speed and you're just sort of seeing, you know, all of the different places and all of the different actions. But if instead it's more like a Proustian moment where you also get to feel all of the feelings and recall all of the dialogue and all of the emotions and just the whole depth of life. If we get a moment like that, and it doesn't have to happen in a second, or maybe it's a second that feels like a good amount of time, that does seem like it would be something to welcome as a way of saying farewell.
Yeah, some sort of final experience of simultaneity. And it's a way of moving from time to being outside of time, whatever that will feel like. I think that Proust gets us as close to that moment as anyone I know.
Hmm. And he did it with writing and writing and writing and adding more and more, you know, pasting paper on top of paper and,
yep.
and continuing
yep.
the process.
Yep.
And
that feeling too, just a little bit more, right? Just a little bit more. I mean, I think there was something to ending one's life with a book that he, in some ways, like, you know, he died in the middle of it. He had written the last sentence already, but he was going back into the middle and continuing to add right up until the last moment.
Okay. Nicholas Dames, thank you so much for joining me on the History of Literature.
Thank you.
Okay, there we go. Knausgård and Proust. The two names will be linked for some time, I think, including today on the History of Literature podcast. My thanks to Nicholas Dames for that insightful cameo appearance. And of course, to our main guest today, Bob Blaisdell, who rejoined us for another illuminating discussion. First Chekhov, and now Knausgård. Bob is playing our tunes. Speaking of which, we'll be playing some tunes for you, so to speak, and we're planning some bonus episodes soon. We're still on the once-a-week schedule, but we have so many wonderful guests who have reached out and asked to come on the show that I've been talking my fool head off. Conversations with ... doing a little of that of my own. In the next episode, it will be a conversation about a forgotten woman of literature, Charmian Kittredge, or as she became known, Charmian Kittredge London. After she married the more famous writer, Jack London. But don't sleep on Charmian. She was a formidable literary figure in her own right, even though we've now largely forgotten her, at least until now, with her new biographer coming along to remind us all that Charmian is worth our time as well. That's my goodness. Are we up to episode 598? That'll be episode 598 and 599. Right after that, that means we're headed toward our episode 600 and episode 601. We have two Jack treats in store for those. But 599 will also be a Jack treat as we have one of our favorite guests back, Bill Eggington, to talk about a philosopher slash filmmaker whose version of Dune might be the greatest movie never made. Actually, I don't think there's much of a rival for that. I think it is the greatest movie never made. We'll hear all about that in the next couple of weeks as well. So stay tuned, dear listeners. I'm Jack Wilson. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time. Thank you.